In your opinion, how capable is Hezbollah to attack the air bases in this northern part, in the central part, and in the southern part of Israel without any help coming from Iran?
They can do damage. They can do damage, particularly in the context of a broader assault coming from Iran and other allies, the whole axis of resistance at once. They will have greater penetrative power because obviously the Israeli air defense will be overwhelmed. There is the possibility that they could inhibit operations at those air bases for what effectively could be the initial phases of this conflict. Certainly Israel will probably try to conduct what they can not out of those air bases exactly for that reason, right? And but we'll have to see. And I should mention that this pretext that has been used by Israel for this whole latest series, this supposed Hezbollah missile or rocket attack that killed a number of Druze civilians, some children, some adults on a football pitch in the middle of a village in the Israeli-occupied Syrian Golan Heights. This is obviously, now we don't know whether Hezbollah actually launched this rocket by mistake, whether it was a result, as it seems to me the most likely scenario, Israeli air defense attempting to bring down a Hezbollah rocket that then dropped on this village, or even a direct Israeli false flag. But what is certainly clear is that the Druze, particularly in this particular settlement, do not support Israel in the slightest. They don't support the occupation. They don't serve in the IDF. Their leaders have specifically said that under no circumstances should the tragedy be used by Israel as the pretext exactly for further violence that they've been using it for. And actually, they drove Israeli ministers out of the funerals of the children that were involved. So we don't know whether it was a deliberate false flag, as some Druze leaders have suggested, or it was an accident of one form or another that the Israelis have exploited, but that's clearly all it was. It was not a Hezbollah attack. And the hilarious, well, in a very cynical black humor variety of terror, they're using this for a pretext on the same day that they bombed another children's hospital in Gaza. So, I mean, anyone who buys that Israel, it was using this as some type of moral justification, that's no one seriously believes that, right? I mean, everyone knows that it is a the most cynical and vile of pretexts in this particular situation.
Yeah, if the outcome, the result of what you've just mentioned would be if something big happens between Iran and Israel, the only leverage the United States has right now would be the air forces going to Iran and attacking Iran. Because on the ground, they're not capable of doing this.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, obviously, I mean, the U.S. has cultivated the Mujahideen calque, and both Israel and the U.S. have supported separatist groups within Iran and in far-flung regions like the Baluchi region in the north and the Azerbaijani. But obviously, they do not have the on-the-ground insurgent forces that could be used to overthrow the government in Iran, even during a long range strike conflict. I don't believe they do. I mean, certainly they'll probably try it. They'll try to do what they can to disrupt Iran, but I certainly don't think it's anything that would be state existential. It could not result, as I understand it, in any type of regime change in Iran. These are mostly ethnic minorities and extremists, and they would not certainly have the support of the Iranian population.
Yeah, I talked with Colin Wilkerson. He said that there are studies in the United States about how to attack Iran, and all of those studies
Oh, sure.
show it's not possible to attack Iran on the ground. That's why the United States was so hesitant to attack Iran so far.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of it. I mean, part of it, I mean, even they know it, there's unquestioned that it would be long range strikes. What has made the U.S. particularly hesitate in this situation is, one, Iran is a lot stronger than it ever has been previously, right? Iran did not previously have the long range strike capability to hit Israel in any substantial way, right? They didn't have the missiles. Supposedly, Iran even has hypersonic missiles. They didn't have the long range drones. They didn't have any of that. This is all new. And Iran had a relatively weak air force. So this is an entirely new dynamic in the situation. And what can be used, of course, to hit Israel can also be used to hit U.S. and United Kingdom military bases throughout the region, right? And Iran has lots of, shall we say, irregular allies with the Houthis and Hezbollah and Kataib Hezbollah. But I would say that the realization of Iran's new long-range strike capability and the growing unease in the Pentagon as they look at their own ever-dwindling stock of air defense interceptor missiles, right? But for Patriot intercept missiles, which is the bedrock of U.S. air defense, right? They are producing somewhere between 550 and 650 air defense interceptor missiles a year. That's it. And that's after ramping up production. Now, most of those are currently going to the Kiev regime in Ukraine, almost all of them, right? And they're going through them like hotcakes. Now, usually when you fire a Patriot interceptor like this, for any given attempted interception, you should fire by procedure two interceptor missiles, right, to increase your chance of a successful interception, which by no means guarantees it, but that's what they do. So two missiles per interception. Russia is firing, according to Western statistics, 4,000 missiles at the Kiev regime in Ukraine a year. You do the math. I mean, obviously, they're not that. And this is nothing new. Actually, before this conflict broke out, there were reports of a critical shortage of Patriot interceptor missiles and of the poor performance of the Patriots from Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia used them a lot during their then conflict with the Houthis to stop attack on Saudi oil fields, Saudi airports. They had a very low success rate with the Patriot systems firsthand. There were reports in the Western media at the time of how incapable the Patriot was performing for the job, and also then how critically short already the U.S. was of Patriot missiles to supply Saudi Arabia with. They were actually arranging for other Arab countries that had Patriot systems to transfer their Patriot interceptors to Saudi Arabia and giving those countries an IOU on them because they had a critical shortage even before the Russian intervention in the Ukrainian civil conflict. So very bad military industrial planning and situation there for the United States. That is what they are most afraid of. They can't protect their bases in the Middle East. They can't protect Israel from Israeli or Iranian long-range strikes, because Iran, by all accounts, has a very large range arsenal of missiles and drones capable of hitting both Israel and Western military bases in the Middle East. That is what they are most afraid of, is Iran's, you know, it's something that Iran hasn't had before. This is something new. It is a new dynamic. And the U.S. is caught woefully unprepared for it. And at this bad time when, you know, they've diverted all Patriot system and interceptor production to Ukraine. They just announced that in the last month, that everything they're making now has to, all other customers are deprioritized to send as much as they can to Ukraine. And the Russian Ministry of Defense put out another series of videos of another three Patriot launchers that they wiped out this week, right? So Russia's destroying them faster than the West can provide Patriots to Ukraine. And another, you know, long range strike threat, you know, with the, you know, the political necessity of defending Israel. The U.S. just isn't capable of it. They're not a military superpower, you know, in relative terms to the rest of the world, the way they were in the 1990s and the early 2000s. The world has changed. Iran is stronger, right? Technology has resulted in the proliferations of drones, which, if you'll remember, the U.S. was the first one to start using drones in a major military way. The same thing with cruise missiles and other long-range strikes. This is proliferated now. The Houthis are firing cruise missiles, right? They're manufactured, you know, with Iranian assistance, almost certainly. But it has resulted in a changing of the military balance. And it is not a balance in the U.S. favor. And all of that is exacerbated by the U.S. being completely overextended and militarily stockpile exhausted from the proxy war in Ukraine. They can't even provide for that conflict, much less another conflict in the Middle East. So I would say that it is the threat of Iranian long-range strikes and the inability of the U.S. to provide sufficient air defense for that, that has them most scared at this point, right? And that, of course, goes to what would be U.S. naval forces, you know, within the theater, within the Persian Gulf as well. They would be a threat. There are lots of U.S. war games that have been run that resulted in the military people assigned to play the role of Iran in the war games successfully using unorthodox anti-symmetric measures, like essentially kamikaze boats and the like, to wipe out U.S. aircraft carriers. And you can be sure the Iranians have been spending far more time about thinking about how they could do that. At a minimum, a major conflict like that involved naval and air forces engaging in the Persian Gulf would cut off the world's oil supply coming out of the Persian Gulf. It would, you know, completely inhibit it for some period of time. Who would that benefit? Russia. Russia, the major oil and gas supplier to the world. So they would be shooting themselves in the foot, one going one way, coming another. It is a geopolitical nightmare scenario for this to happen to them, you know, or, you know, them to be involved in this fashion right now. It is, you know, it's not quite a perfect storm, you know, that overused expression, but it's a really, really bad. It's a really bad one. I believe the U.S., the Biden administration, will do their best to avoid this scenario, right? Everyone will be trying not to give Netanyahu what he so clearly wants, but with a weakened Biden administration, a lame duck presidency there, with a power vacuum in the White House, and an Iranian president who will feel he just got inaugurated and he had this dropped in his lap, right? With all the provocations that Iran has suffered, whether both sides can continue not giving Netanyahu what he thinks he wants it's getting harder. It's getting harder, you know, and we'll see whether we've crossed real red lines and to what extent and how much further they'll be crossed and how much this will spiral out of control in the next, you know, probably days, hours, days. And it could potentially be very geopolitically bad for the United States. I don't see any good scenario for them. The best they can do is to quiet it back down, you know, to the level that it has been, which again, it's increasingly hard to keep a lid on this. And again, it's not to say that the US is innocent, right? They're providing targeting data. They've had special forces down on the ground in Palestine. They are supporting Israel. Well, the problem here for Israel and the US is the bad personal relations between Biden and Netanyahu. But Netanyahu just got feted by the entire US Congress, and he feels he can just run right over Biden at this point. And maybe he can. We'll find out.
Yeah. We've learned that the Biden administration said to Netanyahu that this time would be the last time that they're going to defend Israel against Iran. And when they're
Sure.
talking about this, in your opinion, is it coming from the Biden administration, or is it coming from the neocons, the blob, who are the people who are behind the scene, that they're not willing to continue the conflict in the Middle East?
It's first of all, I don't believe that statement. That is nonsense. And the Biden administration is out in a few months anyway. Trump and Vance will take over. I believe that's coming. You know, I have not actually heard that statement myself, sitting down to this. If I and if
Just
I
came
did,
out before we do the
before we sat down, okay, I wouldn't believe it. I wouldn't believe it if I heard it. The U.S. is really, even having been born and spent the first 28 years of my life in the United States, right, serving in the military, I cannot begin to fathom the U.S. political hardwired obsession with Israel that often seems to put Israel over U.S. interests. Certainly, part of it is the power of the Israeli lobby, IPAC, the American Israeli Political Action Committee. If you go against Israel in U.S. politics, that's it. That is a career ruining move. That is how much power they have, how much money they tribute. John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt. John Mearsheimer, the great international relations realist scholar. Stephen Walt, also an extremely intelligent realist, a professor at Harvard Kennedy School of Government. You know, they wrote together a book, The Lobby, talking about the power and the toxic influence that IPAC has over U.S. foreign policy, and has, in their estimation, which I certainly agree with, the U.S. acting outside of their national interests in support of Israel, you know, forever. And of course, they were labeled anti-Semites for writing the book. And the book was completely dismissed, because that's, you know, any if you're anti-Israel, that equates to anti-Semitism now. In fact, that's actually what they are saying, literally now. Before, it was just they're now they've literally, you cannot criticize Israel in the U.S. It cannot be done. If you do, you're an anti-Semite, and that's it. Another reason I believe, first of all, part of it is geopolitical. The Israel provides a platform for U.S. power projection and control of the Middle East, always has. In fact, at one point, Joe Biden himself said that if Israel didn't exist, the U.S. would have to create it, because of the capabilities it provided the U.S. in the Middle East. So that's a second cause, is geopolitical. A third one is this bizarre phenomenon of what some people call Christian Zionism, or this apocalyptic trend in some born-again Baptist, whatever, I don't know, U.S. Religious Christian religious derivations, particularly in the American South, where they believe Something I don't even entirely something with the reconstruction of the wall and in Jerusalem and the temple, and that this will herald the coming of Christ, which is a weird twisting of Christian and Jewish mythology that seems at odds with each other. It's absolutely bizarre and a little frightening, to be frank, but there is definitely a very kind of zealotous religious component for particularly many Republicans, at least in the South as well. But I've never understood it. It is hardwired into the U.S. political elite, to the institutions. I don't believe this statement. If they say it, they're out of office in a few months anyway. And I don't believe, certainly don't believe that that's coming from the blob, from the deep state, right? The real directors of foreign and military policy, the unelected bureaucrats who don't go from and they're a little bit more than that. It's a much more ideological component, a more substantiated, without quite being a secret cabal. It's not quite that, but it is something in between that directs U.S. foreign and military policy, through and over the heads of U.S. presidencies, as the first Trump presidency clearly proved, right? I mean, he campaigned, the one single foreign policy, consistent foreign policy promise he made while campaigning for his first presidency was improving relations with Russia, for whatever reason. And the exact opposite happened, because, he ended up hiring who he could, right? You have to hire people who are qualified for positions in political positions over the security services and the military and whatnot. And when you take a look at qualified people, they all come out of the same ideological churn mill, right? There's very few people that are outside that type of hegemonist, exceptionalist creation system of people with qualifications for the jobs, right? I mean, it's just in recent years that we have even one think tank in DC, the Kinsey Institute, that is outside of that hegemonist ideological exceptionalist framework. And certainly you can't staff a government out of the Kinsey Institute. What they're doing is great, and I read them, even when I disagree with them, assiduously. But I don't believe the statement, and I certainly don't believe it's coming from the deep state. And I don't believe that the Israeli-U.S. marriage can just be washed away. It's impossible. It's nonsense, even.
If you remember, before Trump getting elected, he was talking about Syria, how he's planning to withdraw all the troops from Syria. He couldn't do that in those days.
He couldn't do that. He couldn't withdraw troops from Afghanistan, which he wanted to do before he got out of office. All of these limitations. The U.S. president has let, even though his specific constitutional powers as the head of the executive branch, actually are really far more to do with foreign and military decision making than anything to do with the domestic framework. Which is bizarre, because the very last thing that Americans actually vote on when choosing the presidency is foreign and military matters, right? They vote on their pocketbooks, domestic, the culture wars, everything. The last things that the constitutional powers of the president supposedly deal with. But even with those constitutional powers, the U.S. president finds that he comes into office and he inherits a deep state, right? A blob, a permanent bureaucracy, that he has very little ability to actually shift it, right? Very limited, right? Imagine being in charge of a ship that you could only move it, like 1 or 2 degrees.
Mark, the problem here right now is not, the question is not if United States is willing to do that to defend Israel, but the main question would be, how capable is the United States to defend Israel in the future with the current face of the Middle East, these huge changes that are happening? Even Erdogan, before this assassination, was talking about invading Israel.
Okay, Erdogan is just talking smack, right? Erdogan is not serious. He's a blowhard pandering to his domestic political Islamist base, right? That there is no reality to that whatsoever, none, right? Out there, I'm sure many of you have probably seen the meme, the video meme on the internet, where you see two groups of dogs ferociously barking at each other with a metal gate in between them. And they're just frothing at the mouth, throwing themselves, threatening to rip each other apart if only this metal gate didn't separate them. And this metal gate is one of these automatic sliding gates. And suddenly some human down there somewhere opens the gate and it just slides open, and the two packs of dogs are left staring at each other with nothing in between them, and they just both wander off. That is Erdogan and Netanyahu. Please do not take Erdogan seriously on this. All this rhetoric back and forth is nothing. But to your broader point, obviously, the long-term capability of the U.S. to defend Israel in the Middle East is going down. It's decreasing. Even with an increased level of European political support for Israel that has not existed, let's face it, when it comes to military powers, I think the results of European military capability contributing to the proxy war in Ukraine have demonstrated how woefully inadequate European military power is. So even with that, obviously power dynamics are changing. And another major thing that has changed is Saudi Arabia moving away from the United States, right? They haven't completely left the United States, but obviously they've decided on they want more options. They want a multi-vector foreign policy. They joined BRICS. They joined a level of affiliation with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. They're no longer the willing U.S. vassals that they once were. And that changes a lot of the power dynamics in the Middle East as well, because U.S. hegemony over the Middle East since, the late 70s has been premised on the U.S. Having bilateral relationships with Israel on one hand and Saudi Arabia on the other, and all of them united in their opposition, their hatred of Iran, right? Iran is the enemy. And with first the really geopolitically idiotic U.S. destruction of Saddam Hussein, which was keeping Iran's power contained in Iraq, and the rise of a Shia government in Iraq, inevitable, once you give them quote unquote democracy, that really opened Iran up power-wise to spread, to collaborate with Shias throughout the Middle East and the way it has, and removed any serious geographic military threat to them. The second thing, the major thing that has changed just recently is Saudi Arabia decamping from the U.S. and saying, yeah, your wars in the Middle East, we're not a part of that anymore. And they're not bosom buddies with Iran, but they have restored diplomatic relations. This is quite obvious that the relations between the two have improved. It's obvious that Saudi Arabia is moving away from a hostile geopolitical position with Iran, as you know, much as you know, we can expect within the limited time frame. And by the reports I've heard, Mohammed bin Salman actually wrote a very congratulatory message to the new Iranian president on the timing of his inauguration. Quite sincerely. So that's another pillar of this U.S. hegemony over the Middle East. And when you add into that not only Iran's increased geopolitical presence in the Middle East, but the new technological long-range strike capability that they have, that they didn't have before, that they have distributed throughout the axis of resistance, hence Houthis attacking shipping, American warships in the Red Sea, U.S. aircraft carrier turning tail and running out of the Red Sea because of Houthi attacks, right? It's a new military ballgame, and things are changing, and everyone is learning from the drone and AI evolutions that are occurring cyclically, monthly. Evolution is happening in the Russian Western proxy war in Ukraine. That's driving everything else. And we see now, when you take a look at how badly the Russian Black Sea Fleet has done just against Western maritime drones provided to the Kiev regime in the Black Sea, how vulnerable navies, surface vessels are to that type of drone warfare now, which is something that Iran and the Houthis that everyone else can unleash on the United States is, naval assets, which were, a pillar of their power projection capability, now vulnerable in a way they never were before, as well as the aerial drones, the missiles, and Iran has become a major missile power, right? And again, supposedly, even hypersonic missiles, something the U.S. is struggling, right? It's a new ball game technologically, and no one quite knows what, if it all goes down now, everything is uncertain. No one knows exactly how things are going to break down. The U.S. still has tremendous military capabilities, a lot of it coming from their satellite network, their C4ISR, their ability to do GPS guided strikes and everything. That, don't underestimate that. That has been one of the major abilities that they have transferred to the Kiev regime in Ukraine that has kept the Kiev regime in the fight as long as they have. Simply intelligence, satellite data, reconnaissance, C4ISR, the whole nine yards. It's very substantial. And that will certainly be a big leg up that the U.S. will have over Iran. But you can also be sure that Russia and China will provide what data they have, and together that's quite substantial, and China's is growing just astronomically all the time, and will, in a very short, within a decade, catch up and probably surpass the United States in that regard. And Russia's really increasing their game there as well. That intelligence advantage is maybe not what it once was either. I don't know how things will actually play out, right? How this long-range strike war will take place. And I don't think anyone can realistically tell you that they do. A lot of U.S. military experts told us all sorts of things that they expected to happen in Ukraine, and they were all so fucking wrong that it's laughable. It looks like laughable propaganda now, and it's hard to tell what was propaganda and what was just, really bad analysis. So if anyone tries to tell you that, they know what's going to happen in a long-range strike war between Israel and the U.S. that sets to fire the entire Middle East, I don't know, and I certainly don't think they do either. But I know enough to know that it is going to be earth-shattering. It's really going to be, it's not going to be a global conflict. We're not going to, World War III is much more likely to come out of the conflict in Ukraine than it is to come out of this conflict. But don't underestimate the importance of the Middle East geopolitically still has to the world, the flow of gas, oil and gas out of the region, and increasingly other things like finance and out of the UAE. So it's still an important region geopolitically in the world. And what we've seen is a relative erosion of the U.S. geopolitical power in the region, the rise of more autonomous regional individual politics like Saudi Arabia, and increasing Russian and Chinese influence and Iranian influence being an actual participant in the region in the last few years. The rise of Iran was a direct result of the U.S. war to overthrow Saddam Hussein. That is one of the, I think it might be one, it's certainly in the top five geopolitical blunders of all time.
Don't you think that one of the main objectives of this assassination was that agreement that China could do between among those Palestinian groups? And they have reached an agreement to go after two-state solution. By this assassination, they can sabotage that two-state solution that Hamas has agreed on.
Possibly. But Hamas was always going to be the hardest to convince to agree to that unified Palestinian position. And they've, however, temporarily made Hamas weaker, right? But this agreement may become lost in larger events if they play out, you know, in worst case scenarios, right, of a regional conflagration. Palestinian unity means much less than it would otherwise. But one of the things it does do is it prevents any ceasefire or hope of an end to the Israeli-Hamas conflict completely, right? It just completely wipes out. And not only did they, according to the Israeli government, not only have they killed the political chief of Hamas, but according to them, just over a week ago, they also took out the military chief of Hamas, which they weren't evident, supposedly they weren't sure that they had got him. And now they've announced that, yes, now they have confirmation that they did get him. So they've wiped out both the political and military leadership. Now, of course, those people have already been replaced. You know, Hamas is self-regenerating. You know, it's again, you're trying to defeat an idea of the Palestinian people. And as long as the Palestinian people are there, Hamas will continue, will recover. So it's only a temporary thing, but it does put an end to any hopes whoever might have had of a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel and certainly any larger peace negotiations. That it certainly does. And that will inevitably affect, you know, the Chinese brokered political agreement between them as well. Even if it's only becoming lost in this broader thing. But that Palestinian agreement brokered by China only matters if there is peace, right? If there's no peace, it has no ability to emerge and represent the Palestinian people in total, which again is tenuous, but you know, kudos to China for trying. I mean, China, the great peacemaker. That is, you know, the underreported story. China, it was that helped broker the final stages, at least, of the Iranian Saudi rapprochement. It's China that is doing their best to talk sense into the Kiev regime in Ukraine. And a host of other conflicts around the world. China is emerging as the role that, you know, we all in a more childlike hope that the U.S. would be the one, the peacemaker, the shining city on the hill, bringing peace to the world. And they brought the exact opposite. And The Chinese Communist Party, as the American politicians love to pronounce, is actually the one doing more than anyone else to walk the talk, to talk the walk, and vice versa of peace around the world, which, you know, it should hopefully upend the geopolitical assumptions that a lot of people have had about their own country's place in the world and the Chinese place in the world. It should.